This is Scripture Read Badly,
a podcast where two grown-up pastors' kids discuss the stories of the Bible in chronological order,
attempting to avoid heresy and generally having a good time.
I'm Jeremy.
And I'm Ryan.
Sit back and rejoice. Today's verse comes to us from the book of Joshua, chapter 7, verse 3. And they returned to Joshua and said to him, "Do not have all the people go up, but let about 2,000 or 3,000 men go up and attack Ai. Do not make the whole people toil up there, for they are few." This is the first example that we have in the Bible of picking teams for dodgeball. It's like, yeah, we'll have those guys, we'll have those guys. But don't let those guys be in our team because they suck. This is Scripture Read Badly. I am Jeremy, and with me, as always, is...
Ryan, and nobody likes Chicken Little. He's always the last one on the team.
Chicken Little is the worst. He's the Jeremy Randall of sports.
Yeah. Are you using yourself there as the the measure of being bad at something?
Yeah, even as an adult, I go to places that they're picking, I'm like, oh, well, I'll be the last. I'll take one for the team. And then sometimes I'm picked first, like... I broke my finger recently playing dodgeball, and I was always, like, the second chosen because they were all, like, 7, 8, 9-year-olds. Yeah. And because I was quite tall, they were like, that guy must be good at this game. That guy was not good at this game.
Okay, so you broke your finger playing dodgeball. We have to hear that story before we get into today's Bible stuff.
You know dodgeball, right?
Yeah, I know dodgeball. Yeah. I've seen the movie. I've played the game.
And it's quite a violent game. Yeah. And in Australia, sometimes we played a version called bin ball, and it had three balls, and if you hit the bin, then all of your team members came back, and if you caught the ball in the full, whoever threw it was out. So the strategy was certain that you bounced it a lot, whereas in Lithuania, it's called kvadratas, which is like a form of the word square, and there's only one ball, and if you catch it on the full, nothing happens, but if you bounce it off the ground and hit someone, they're not out. So you have to hit them on the full.
Oh.
And then there's no way to get any team members back. So if you're out, you're out for good, but you go behind the line and you can still throw the ball at people from behind.
Oh, okay.
So the strategy in my mind just changed. And I would get out and I'd be like, that's not out. I caught you on the full or something. And they're like, no, get out. So I played convincingly for a day because I was at this children's camp in the middle of nowhere. And although in Lithuania that doesn't really exist because there's towns everywhere.
Yeah.
And the second day, halfway through the game, I just caught the ball wrong, like horrifically wrong. And I knew something was wrong with my finger, but I just thought it was jarred. I didn't think it was broken. So I kept playing. And then that night, it had gone purple. So I messaged a picture of it to my friend who's just graduated as a doctor. And I was like, could this be broken? And she was like, yeah, fingers are definitely never supposed to look like that. But I didn't have my medical insurance with me, so I was waiting till I was back in the capital to take my medical insurance to the hospital. And I'd never been to a hospital here. And you talk to half the people who've gone to hospitals here, and they're like, oh, it's all Soviet and gross, and you never get seen to and blah, blah, blah. And none of my Lithuanian friends could come with me.
Yeah.
So I went to the hospital. And it was just like Australia. Like, I took a number, and I waited for 3 hours, and then I got seen to and then asked to leave, and it was fine. Yeah. Like, it was such a fun experience.
Nice.
But now I have a broken finger, it's so dumb. So, chapter 7 of Joshua is when they've just come off a high of destroying Jericho, and their trust in God is quite high, and at the end of the chapter... No, not at the end, but just before they take over Jericho, God makes it clear, do not take anything from this city, just destroy it, except Rahab and her family. So they save a specific people that help them, and they destroy everything else. And then they front up to this city A or I or I-E.
A-I-E-O-U, one of the vowels.
Definitely one of the vows. And once again, Joshua sends men to go and spy out the land. And what do you think when they're spying, they're looking for?
Weak spots, potential military threats, the normal things that that people would try and spy out on a scouting mission before a battle.
Yeah, but they've never been to these places. Like, they've come out of the wilderness to a completely new land.
Yeah.
And they actually need to know where they're going. Mm-hmm. And so these spies come back and say, don't have everyone come up because we've just wasted this other city and we don't need everyone to do that because God's behind us and we can win everything.
Mm-hmm.
So then, and for some reason, Joshua's like, yeah, that makes sense. I'll listen to the spies who just looked at the land and only sends a few people. And then what happens?
Verse 5, the men of Ai killed about 36 of their men and chased them before the gates as far as Shebarim and struck them at the descent. And the hearts of the people melted and became as water.
She's so sad.
So does that mean their hearts were ice before? I don't know.
Yeah, but they were icy cold.
Yeah. Well, that's it's similar imagery to what we've had already in the Book of Joshua. And I think it might be unique to this book, or at least this may have been the first introduction of that terminology, to have your heart melting in fear before the enemy. When Rahab talked about her city being like that with Israel. So now Israel has gone and chucked to Jericho, where they've seen defeat and their hearts have melted in fear of the people of Ai instead of the people of Ai's hearts melting in fear because of the God of Israel. So they've done something wrong.
And it's funny that whoever wrote the book is very specific about the amount of people that died.
Yeah.
Like about 36, maybe 37, but yeah. It's definitely around that number. And I wonder if that's symbolic, like if the number 36 is symbolic, or if it was just definitely, oh, we only left 36 up behind.
Yeah.
Out of 3,000, that's not very big.
Yeah, well, we don't exactly know how many... oh, right, yeah. So the 3,000 men, only 36 died, which is comparatively not that many. I mean, it's just over... Yeah. What? It's just over 1% of the entire group of people that went there. But they got chased out, and I think that was the thing that made them get scared.
Yep.
But like you said, the fact that Joshua listened to the spies instead of listening to God and stepping out in obedience to God, that may have been one of the mistakes that led to this defeat. But now I have something else to ask you, Jeremy, and that is, at the beginning of chapter 7, obviously we have that Achan, the son of Carmi, and I'm going to keep saying that because Achan is fun to say, from the tribe of Judah, he took some of the devoted things, and so God's anger burned against Israel. Do you think if he hadn't taken them, and these 3,000 men had gone out against the city of Ai, that they would have come back victorious?
Yes, and definitely. And okay. It would have been a bigger victory, because later in the chapter of 8, it says that there were 12,000 people defeated at Ai.
Wow, okay.
And so taking 3,000 people to defeat 12,000 is quite a Gideon victory, or even bigger.
Yeah.
And God would have been all about that, but because they had sinned and taken devoted things, it didn't work.
Mm. Okay, so it could be that Joshua didn't do anything wrong. It was just that Achan, the son of Carmi, took some of the devoted things, wrong. And consequently the entire nation of Israel suffered a military setback. And
definitely.
So then Achan may have been the responsible himself for those 36 people dying.
Yep.
So take that, Achan. I wonder what will happen to him.
Yeah, take that. Well, yeah, we wonder. And then it's interesting, too, that reported in 6, Joshua tears his clothes and falls to the earth. So his response to this isn't, I trusted you, God, and I'm going to stop trusting you. His response is, what did we do wrong? Like, there must have been something wrong, and we have to repent and confess for it.
Yeah.
And so he says, alas, O God, why have you brought this people over the Jordan at all to give us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us? we would be content to dwell beyond the Jordan. Like, why did you bring us all this way if we're just going to die?
Yeah.
And it gives God the opportunity to be like, well, something wrong happened and we have to deal with it.
Okay, right. So God is like what happened many times with Moses and the Israelites in the wilderness. God is pointing out the sin of one person and showing the impact that sin can have on an entire nation. And yep. effectively instilling in the people of Israel the fear of, not the fear, but the hatred of sin.
Yep.
And the desire to be far from it, because they get to see the physical consequences firsthand. And
yep.
And in some cases, people die as a result. So
yeah, but it's interesting too that this is the start of something big. Like God is bringing them into the promised land. And this one person out of however many there were took something, and that's to blame for something that God takes issue with. And then you fast forward to the start of the church, and Ananias and Sapphira take something, and it's theirs to take, but they don't. They still take it, and God's like, this is so bad in the start of what we're starting that you need to cease to exist. And I wonder if that's a big, important thing for God. Like, when I'm starting something new, when I'm pioneering something great, I want my people to be holy. Like, I want my people to be so blameless that if they're not, I'm just going to take them out. Because then, when things are established, like when David's kingdom was established, he committed adultery. And yeah, his baby died. But it wasn't like God took him out specifically. He gave him other children and other people through his kingdom. And so I wonder if there's something there that God is so intimately entwined with pioneering stuff that he needs us to be extra holy.
Okay, well, when you consider the parable of the sower, or the parable of the seeds or the plants or whatever you want to call it, Jesus talks about how in this parable, this dude throws, scatters seed in an explosive kind of manner, as was the custom in that kind of, in that region. They just have to throw a whole handful of seeds out into one area in order that some of them may take root. And what seeds take root, if they are in good soil, grow up and they reap an enormous crop. But if they fall among thorns, then as they grow, the thorns will choke the life out of them and it'll be worse than if no seed was scattered at all. Because then it gives false hope. It, I guess, would lead the farmer on in thinking that he had more crops than he did. And so that's what I'm kind of thinking about with this corruption and God's distaste for it, or even his orders against it for the sake of keeping something holy further down the line. Like you said, if there were these seeds of corruption that that Achan allowed into the camp of Israel, if each time they went to a city, an extra person took a little bit of this and a little bit of that, then you get to the end and their hearts would be turned against God, because they would then be coveting the material possessions of the people whom they are going to invade, as opposed to wanting to destroy it for the sake of purifying the land. So the conquest never would have worked if Achan didn't die for his sin.
Similar a little bit to the kingship too. Like, God's like, I don't want to give you a king. And then they're like, nah, we really want a king. And he's like, all right, I'll give you one. But these are the stipulations I want your king to have. And one of them is, don't intermarry with people who don't believe that God is the God.
Yeah.
Because then if you're leading a country and your wife believes something different, then of course some people are going to be like, that sounds interesting. I want to worship trees.
Yep. Exactly. So now we have, so God's response was that,
he's like, get up, why have you fallen on your face?
Yeah.
Israel has sinned. So he's just like, stop whining, stop asking stupid questions, deal with this guy.
Yeah, and so what I want to say about this is, I think it's interesting that God says that the entire nation of Israel has sinned, when in reality it was just Achan taking some stuff. Because I think if we take that same approach to sin in our own lives, then we will go about pursuing holiness in a whole lot better way than if we said, yeah, I'm doing really well in these areas, but over here, I'm not doing very well, but
yeah,
whatever, I'm doing well in these other areas. God's view of things was not, you defeated Jericho, this is awesome, you're gaining ground. Yeah, you could probably do with not taking some stuff over there, but keep going, you're going to make it. Instead, he was saying, taking that stuff after defeating Jericho is going to tear you down in the long run.
Yeah.
So we need to get rid of that stuff so that the conquest, the actual, the mission on which they were going about things in Canaan, so that that could actually be fruitful the way it was meant to be. So with sin, and let me know if you disagree with this or not, but with sin, if we consider the areas in which we're doing well and say, these are our strengths at the moment, but over here our weaknesses are not that great, but it's okay, I'll deal with them further down the line. Do you think that that is just as toxic as if you maybe had a broken toe when you started at a long-distance race and thought, it's painful, but I'll deal with it when the race is over, or you had some kind of spreading weeds in the garden or something like that, I'll deal with them when they're fully grown? Do you think that those that kind of the mix of analogies that I've just made there is kind of what God is going for here, that he's saying get it out straight away so that further down the line things will not have the snare?
Yeah, well, cool. And I think, back to what I was saying before, you don't run a marathon on a broken toe because you'd be ineffective. Like, you'd be slower than everyone else because you're broken.
Yeah.
And so this part of Israel is broken and it needs to be fixed. I think, and that's also why I'm saying that sometimes God doesn't deal with all of our sin at the same time, because sometimes in our lives that would just crush us. Or we wouldn't have the time to do all of them. So he takes issue with stuff at the time and leaves the rest, I suppose. Because I know of times in my life where I've had like four definite sins going on and God's just like, I need you to take care of this one right now.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, well, what about all of these other ones? But he's just taking issue with this specific one.
Right. Yeah. And now Yeah, I'm with you on that. I do believe that having a very hard legalistic approach to your own sin can be quite detrimental, I think, to your spiritual health. As in, if you're passing judgment on yourself as opposed to taking actions to reduce the size of the sin, I guess. So you can celebrate the victories that you're having as well as going about defeating something slowly. But I think letting it stagnate, letting it sit there, I think what God is, maybe, what may be the lesson that we can take from this is that God wants us to treat things as though they are sin, as opposed to ignoring them as if they weren't. So if you had four different sins that God was pointing out to you that were keeping you from being in a full relationship with him, and he said, focus on this one, get rid of this one, and then we'll get rid of the next one. You have to take things one step at a time. I don't think God's approach, just from what I've read of the Bible and even considering something like Ananias and Sapphira in the New Testament, I don't think God's approach to little sins is that they're fine, just ignore them, pursue holiness, and they'll go away. He wants us to be active in opposing something negative as well as moving forward.
Yep.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think in this context, there was probably other sins going on that they were dealing with, but this was like not a new one, but it was a new one in their experience of trashing and taking over different cities. And because he had just told them not to do it.
Yeah.
So it was affecting their movement.
Yeah.
And if we had a Bible that was full of, and Jimmy Stewart then stole a goat and they had to stone him and everyone's sin was written down, the Bible would be huge.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you and I ourselves would be in there many, 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 many times.
My sin Bible would be an okay size.
Yeah. That's right, just by yourself, as opposed, let alone with everybody else in the entire world.
Maybe it would just be coded, so every paragraph was just like, T, F, T, G, T, G. And that's just like one day. And then the next day there's another code.
Oh, man. Oh, man. All right, so God says that Israel's broken the covenant, and he's saying, therefore, they can't stand before their enemies. So he is drawing the direct correlation between the breaking of the covenant and the negative consequences, which were stated when he established this mission with Moses and with Joshua. So he's basically saying, I warned you that this would happen, and it's happened. 36 people are dead because one person sinned. So what are we going to do about it? How are we going to go about renewing this covenant? What is your way forward? So then he says, get up, basically stop moping. And I don't think God was saying, you shouldn't have come to me in prayer and intercession. I think he's saying, that's enough. Thank you for crying out to me, but now you need to take an action. You need to get up. You need to move forward, as opposed to wallowing in it. Because I think there's a difference between pointing out a difficulty that you're having to somebody and wallowing in the difficulty itself.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right, so what happens after God tells him to consecrate the people?
Hey, hang on, I'm just yawning. Because I had too much breakfast and I had food coma.
Mm.
So he says there are devoted things in your midst.
Yep.
And he points out who he needs to bring. So they come by lot,
mm-hmm.
by clans, and the clans shall take them by households, and the households blah, blah, blah. So he slowly gets down to the family that the man is from.
Mm-hmm.
And so he does that. And it shows us what clans he's from, blahdy, blahdy, blahdy. And then he brought near his household man by man, and Achan, the son of Carmi, was taken.
Yep. Right before we move on there, I just want to point out something God said in verse 11 was that he had not only stolen, but he had lied about putting the things in his own possession.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just that he'd taken things, but it was that he had withheld that information from everybody else, or potentially even just from the leadership or from the side of God. So maybe his household could be at fault as well, because they probably knew that he'd taken stuff, but they didn't tell anyone, probably out of fear and wanting to preserve them or something.
Yeah, exactly. If they came back and like, I brought some devoted things back, then they would just get killed straight away.
Yeah, probably.
So he kind of had to hide it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then what?
Oh, so Joshua asks him to give glory to the Lord and give praise to him and also confess to what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know how quickly this happens. We don't know how nervous Achan was.
Was he tortured?
But he says, no, it doesn't seem like it.
Yeah.
He's just asked to answer.
Yeah, I was just asking a question. What if he was tortured? I don't think he was. I've been watching too many Netflix
Marvel
shows.
Hot pokers, get him!
Yeah.
And he confesses straight up, truly I've sinned against the Lord, and this is what I did. And he took some silver, he took some gold, and he says that he coveted them, and so he just took them and hid it in the earth inside my tent with silver underneath. And so, yeah, I think his family probably did, because he can't put up these huge tents by himself, and he would have had to do it in the sight of someone, unless he was super sneaky, but it seems not so much.
Mm-hmm.
And so then Joshua sends the messages to see if this is true, because, yeah, he could confess to something, but they needed to see it. They needed to bring it out so that they could destroy it.
Yeah.
But then Joshua asks, why did you do this? Like, you know that God told us not to take these things. Why did you do this? The Lord brought trouble on us today because of you.
Mm.
But it doesn't say that he responds to that question, because it just says all Israel stoned him with stones,
yeah,
as opposed to stoning him with microphones or yeah. pigeons made of wood.
Wow.
And the they pigeons. Burned them with fire and stoned them with stones a second time.
Yeah. So it does say that it wasn't just him, but also his sons and daughters, his oxen and donkeys and sheep, and his tent and all that he had.
And his tent.
So they would, they were completely wiping his name and his legacy off of the face of the earth as a result of the sin. And that was even with him having confessed. But I think the difference there is, I think, repentance. It seems as though he confessed, but he didn't take action in the other direction, which we see a lot in the New Testament when Jesus says, you've done this and you've done this. And the person says, yeah, that's true, I've done it. But now I'm going to go out and... Zacchaeus, for example, Jesus said, you've stolen from people. And he says, yeah, I have. But this is my confession, and now this is my action in response, my repentance. I'm going to go out and give people more than I took from them. And I think that difference in attitude is possibly implied in the lack of follow-up on this guy's confession.
Yep.
Because I don't imagine that, even with the example of David, David did something wrong, obviously. He slept with Bathsheba, and she conceived. That was detestable. Then he sent Bathsheba's husband to the front line, and he got killed. And then the prophet Nathan came and said, you've done this, you've done that. And David's like, oh, I suck. I've done something terrible. But then in response, he laid on his face before God and said, what can I do to make things right with you? And I think the fact that David, or in, and even in other places, like with Moses, with the striking of the rock and things, there are moments where they confess to their sins, but then they either present themselves before God and ask what they can do to improve their right standing with him, or they go out and they sacrifice in response to what they've done. And so this guy didn't seem to have that same response. What do you think?
But also, even if he had repented, I think if he is to blame for 36 deaths, there were parts of their law that was like murderers get treated a certain way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And back, like further on, they have the cities of refuge. So if the murderer, like it could be said as manslaughter because he didn't directly kill the 36 people.
Right.
And if he can get to the cities of refuge before the murderers or the murdered families get to him, then he can be safe as long as he lives in those cities.
Mm.
But it could be said that this is a direct blame of murder and it was 36 people.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder if he's running around with his sons attacking the city and his sons help him take the things, then it's not just him, but he's the head of the household, so his name is being mentioned.
Right, okay.
And so the whole inclusion of the family and the horses and everything is to take out his memory, but also take out what he did so that the people in the future knew, don't take anything that... Because once again, this is the first time they've attacked and taken over a city. And so it's not like they're hardened warriors that know that you shouldn't take out things.
Mm-hmm.
And God's like, even though this stuff is beautiful and you'll want to take it, don't take it. And this guy's like, oh, it's so beautiful, I want that. And so I think what you say is true, but I think it's even more than that.
Mm-hmm. So... also, like you said, I think the amount of stuff that he took, the fact that he took 200 shekels of silver and a bar of gold weighing 50 shekels, it was probably too much for one guy. So he probably would have taken it on his oxen and his donkey, and but probably not because they wouldn't have been with him in Jericho. But like you said, it probably would have been his sons because father's influence over their sons is more than anyone's influence over anyone else. So, so blotting out the entire household because it was most likely the entire household that had done the deed. Yep. Right. Okay, so then they named the place the Valley of Achor, which is sweet.
Which means trouble.
Mm.
Hang on, did you say sweet?
Yeah, I said it was sweet. I think it's a cool name. That's what I meant. Oh, it
doesn't mean sweet?
No. It means trouble.
It's called the Valley of Sweet. Now stone him.
Yeah. Okay, so
and the other thing about stoning is that the community had to do it. So it wasn't just one guy throwing a rock over and over again.
Yeah.
It was the entire community surrounding him, throwing rocks at him, and then covering him with stones. So that's a lot of stones to cover all of the tent and all of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so this would have affected the community quite a lot. Like, God allowed us to take out this thing and told us not to do something, and this guy did something, and this is what he gets.
Yeah. Yep. So then in response to this stoning, God says to Joshua, "Don't be afraid, and don't be dismayed. Take all the fighting men with you, arise and go to Ai." And so then now he's saying, now that that sin is dealt with, now you're going to see victory where you saw defeat before.
Yep.
Okay, yep. So,
and that's an echo from before and after that God keeps telling him, don't be afraid, be courageous.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Totally. So, repetition of a word or a phrase in Hebrew implies emphasis. Ooh. And I think within English it implies emphasis as well, but maybe we could keep that in mind, that the fact that God has to keep telling Joshua to not be afraid means that maybe he was prone to fear, because it was an enormous task that he was given to lead the nation of Israel. And maybe because he had never had a direct leadership role before the passing on of Moses, maybe that meant that he was afraid as the one man in charge of everything. So it could have been a confidence in leadership issue.
But it also could have been that God wanted that communicated to the people as well, because the people were very prone to fear. Mm.
Very true. Very, very true. Yep.
I'm just putting on my new bow tie, so I look real nice.
Wonderful. Well, that's for all our viewers. Okay, so again, he gives the same instruction. Destroy everything. Lay ambush to the city. Lay ambush to the city behind it. Okay, so that means do a sneak attack. Get in behind him. Take out Ai, because they probably weren't expecting an army that just got chased out of there to go around behind them and strike them from behind. Because, okay, so both Jericho and Ai were Amorite cities, right? So they're within the same nation, not that far apart. And Ai would have heard about the defeat of Jericho. So they would have known that Israel was coming with force. So the fact that they were able to defeat Israel boosted their own confidence and their own egos, and probably made them overconfident and cocky. And I think as a result, maybe that would have helped them get caught off guard with an ambush, as opposed to before, when they were instructed to just go take him out head on, and Israel failed. So the tactics have changed because the attitudes of the enemy have changed.
Yep.
Maybe.
Definitely.
Okay.
Yes, and it's interesting that their strategy, like, God doesn't say just go and hit him, just go stab him.
Yeah.
Just like Jericho, there's definitely strategy.
Yeah. And so this time Joshua takes 30,000 mighty men as opposed to 3,000. And he tells them to lay ambush at night. Don't go very far from the city, but everyone needs to stay on their toes and get ready for this battle. And he says that he and a company of some sort, we're not quite sure what that is, just says, all the people who are with me, they will approach the city, and when they come out against us, just as before. So this is saying again that the 3,000 people approach the city head on, Joshua's doing that with a certain amount of people this time, and they're probably thinking, it's the same army, so maybe he only had 3,000 people with him. And they would have thought, it's exactly the same people, they're trying the same tactic, and if anybody out there plays sport, as Jeremy, I know you play dodgeball, if you keep throwing that ball at the one person at their chest and they keep catching it, then you should probably try something else, right?
Yeah.
So then, especially in bin ball, where you have more than one ball, or even dodgeball with multiple balls, regardless of how you play it, if you team up with somebody on your side, you throw the ball at the person's chest, they catch it, but someone else throws it at their legs at the same time, that person's probably going to get out. And so that's kind of what Israel's doing here, bringing it back to dodgeball. Joshua's throwing the ball at their chest, and the rest of the Israelite army are taking out their legs from behind.
Yeah!
Like a bunch of dogs.
Hang on, are you saying that you played bin ball?
I've played bin ball before, yeah.
Okay. Classic. Mm-hmm. I just changed shirts to see if this new bow tie looks good on the other shirt.
Okay, what's the verdict?
But I think you're very true. Oh, I don't know. I haven't looked at my phone yet. I only just put it on. But definitely, they were dressed for victory.
They certainly were.
And I think that is a very good analogy of the different strategies God has tried.
Chosen.
Attempted is the word. Taking them by surprise. It's so funny because if the Israelites had come and just walked around it with trumpets again, who knows what they would have thought?
Yeah. Yeah.
Who knows?
Who does know, really? So Joshua gets up early in the morning, gets everyone up. They go out to Ai, and all the fighting men who were with him went up to the city, and they were on the north side of Ai. And he took 5,000 men with him. Okay. Cool. So we're seeing that he's coming at them with a slightly larger force. They're probably thinking, all right, they've learnt their lesson. They've learnt their lesson. They're back with more numbers. We're ready to beat them again. So then, interestingly, verse 14 of chapter 8 says, as soon as the king of Ai saw that they had camped out in the north, he and all his people, the men of the city, hurried and went out early to the appointed place toward the Arabah, which is a desert, to meet Israel in battle. But they did not know that there was an ambush against them being behind the city. So I think from my understanding of what ancient battles were like, and I got this from Cliff Graham's Mighty Men of David series, the Line of War book series, is mostly they pick out, like with David and Goliath, they picked out the Valley of Elah, they picked out the location of this battle, and they said, we're going to keep this away from our city, but if we lose, you're free to go into our city, I guess. We can't stop you, we're dead. But we're going to have this kind of like a sporting field that they have the match at, as opposed to playing in the street, you know? So that's kind of what they're doing with this battlefield. They've assigned this area outside of the city as where they're going to fight. So they go out to meet them, and then lo and behold, they left the city open, and Israel came in from behind, which is so great. And I think this is definitely the first ambush that we've seen in the Bible so far, but it's certainly not the last. We get to summon Kings and Samuel and stuff. So looking forward to that. So then, Jeremy, take us away from about verse 18 until the end.
Joshua has this javelin, which is just a big old stick with a thing on the end to stab people.
Yep.
And this could be an echo of what Moses had to do with holding his arms up.
Mm.
And if his arms were up, the Israelites won. And if his arms were down, the Israelites would lose. And so God says, stretch out your javelin that is in your hand towards A, for I will give it into your hand.
Yeah.
So it's very much the same. And
but
as
how
we've
can
seen
he
at the
hold
start,
it in his hand if he's already holding the javelin? God can't give it to him in his hand. He's holding the javelin.
Javelins only take one hand, champ.
True.
You can hold a city in the other. Or maybe he has three hands. We haven't been told if he's got three. But I get it. And as we discussed a while back, there has been multiple echoes of Moses in Joshua with the crossing of the river, with the leading of the people, with the circumcising the other generation, and then soon in the second half of this chapter, there will be a renewal of the covenant. But, so he holds the javelin out, and the men in the ambush rose quickly out of their place, and as soon as he had stretched out his hand, they ran and entered the city and captured it. And then, as the men on the playing field look back at the smoke coming off the city, they had no power to flee. And so it was done. They were finished as a city.
Yeah.
And they captured the city, and we assume that they destroyed everything and didn't take any of the dedicated things, because Archon had made sure of that. But in 23, the king of Ai, they took alive and brought him to Joshua.
I think this is the first prisoner of war that we've seen in the Bible. So the king of Ai, the dot, if you will, of Ai, that's who they took. Dotty. Yep. We'll call him Dotty because that's it's a good enough nickname for the one
king
verse
Dotty,
that he's in.
Thank you.
King Dotty.
Hello, I'm King Dotty. And he's a little bit crazy. And everyone thinks he's a little bit unfit to be the king. But somehow he got the position.
He's got the wild eyes and the crazy bushman beard.
Have you seen Disenchantment yet?
No, I have not.
All right, let's not talk about it on air. We'll talk about it later.
Cool.
And then at 25, all that fell that day is 12,000 people. So originally they were going to attack with 3,000. This time they attack with 20,000 with a sweet strategy. But Joshua did not draw back his hand until all of the inhabitants had been devoted to destruction. So just like Moses, he had to keep the javelin up until everything had been finished. And then Joshua burnt Ai and made it forever a heap of ruins as it is to this day.
Wow.
Probably not referring to 2018, but it probably stayed a heap for a long time. Because just like Jericho, they dedicated or they made a statement that whoever rebuilds Jericho, that'll cost him his son and his second son when they put the gates up. So I wonder if they did similar with this city. And then they hung the king on a tree until evening and then threw his body at the gates. Which...
Yeah, so I've heard... I've heard hanging on a tree said that that is very similar to hanging on a cross, if not the same thing, just the Old Testament way of saying it. But... There's nothing in my ESV study Bible that suggests that it is hanging on a cross, but...
Me neither.
I think Paul in Philippians or something, he draws the parallel between the law that says if anyone hangs on a tree, they are a curse. They are cursed. He took that parallel with Jesus hanging on the cross and said Jesus was a curse for us so that we could be right with God. And so I think from the context of my understanding of crucifixion, it is a humiliating death. It is a sign to the passers-by. It is a sign of both victory and defeat. And I think it was just what the Israelites needed on the back of a pretty bad defeat. Although it wasn't completely devastating, the 36 deaths. It was definitely a bit of a shake-up after the victory at Jericho. So they made a symbol of the King of Ai, hung him on a tree until the evening, and they took his body down, threw it at the entrance to the gate of the city, and raised over it a great heap of stones. So they made another monument out of stones, like they did after crossing the Jordan, but this time they made it on top of the corpse of a king. On top of King Dotty.
Yeah, so before, were you referring to King Dotty being the first Jesus?
Maybe the first man crucified. I wouldn't say the first Jesus. Right. There were other people crucified alongside and before Jesus, so I don't...
Why do you think they didn't keep him on the tree as a warning to everyone around, like pirates?
Maybe so that they could get it all done at once. Maybe so they hung him there, he's dead, Yep. He was probably already dead by the time evening came. Otherwise, it wouldn't have said they took his body down. They would have said they took him down. So he's probably already dead, and they thought, all right, let's just chuck him under this big pile of rocks and just leave everything here to smolder. And that is the end of it. We can move forward from there. Because I think if they kept it, if they kept his body, or they chose to do it the next morning or something, maybe it wouldn't have had the same immediate significance as Joshua immediately building an altar to the Lord and turning the focus from the city they just destroyed to the God who they glorified.
Yep.
So there's the renewal of the covenant. Joshua builds an altar on Mount Ebal, just as
Ebola.
Yeah, Ebola. Just as
it's French.
Just as Moses had done and commanded the people of Israel to do, as it is written in the law. And so we've seen these altars throughout the Old Testament, going back to Abraham. And obviously going forward to Moses as well. And everybody, let me see, in the presence of the people of Israel, he wrote on a stone, on the stones, a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written. Wait, so Joshua...
A copy of something of what?
Wait, is that saying God wrote on the stones? Let me see. Let's read this. Joshua made an altar of uncut stones upon which no man has wielded an iron tool, and they offered on it burnt offerings to the Lord and sacrificed peace offerings. And there in the presence of the people of Israel, he wrote on the stones. It seems like it's Joshua. He wrote on the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written. So, maybe
Joshua had written.
That's what it implies. Maybe Joshua being up that big hill before. Was... He might have been the scribe, although.
And then they put everyone. Oh, hang on. Have you already read that?
Nope.
Like they get everyone to stand on the hill, right?
Yeah.
On either side, which is exactly what happened at the end of Deuteronomy too.
Yeah.
Just a different set of mountains.
Yes, different mountains, different location, but the same God and the same covenant being renewed, and God. His covenant is stated to bless the people of Israel. And afterwards, let's see, verse 34. Afterwards, Joshua read all the words of the law, the blessing and the curse, according to all that is written in the book of the law. And there was not a word of all that Moses had commanded that Joshua did not read before all the assembly of Israel, and the women and the little ones and the sojourners who lived among them. I'm just picturing when you are, when you're at school, and you went to library when you're in primary school, and the librarian would sit on the stool in front of everyone as they sat cross-legged on the ground, and they would read a story, and then they would turn the book around and show the pages to everybody, and then they'd turn the book back around and flip the page, read the next words, flip it back around for everybody to see. I'm just imagining Joshua doing that. That would have been so much fun.
Yep.
So
it would have to be quite a large book, though.
Yeah, he must have read it by torchlight. Although it says at that time, so I don't know whether that was...
at that time.
Whether that was while the city was being burnt or whether that was around that same period of time. True. But either way, that brings us to the end of chapter 8 of the book of Joshua. And consequently going on to the Gibeonite deception. And the sun standing still. So we've got a couple of really cool stories coming up in the next couple of chapters. Jeremy, do you have any closing thoughts or advice that you want to share with me and with the listeners as we wrap this episode up?
Yeah, okay. So when you're tying a bow tie, make sure that it doesn't choke even a little bit.
Mm.
Because then sometimes you'll feel like throwing up in front of church. Secondly... drink more water than you think you should, because it's really good for your body, because our body is mostly water. And third, get a good pillow. I've been sleeping on real bad pillows for 8 months, and then I got a really okay pillow. It's not even a great pillow. It's like a 13 euro pillow. And I've slept like a baby for 3 nights. You've been woken up
screaming every 3 hours?
Oh, yeah, you know it.
Yeah.
That's a lot less than usual. A lot less than usual ratio screaming to sleeping.
I love sleeping like a baby.
So don't choke yourself with a bow tie. I've forgotten what I said second, and get a good pillow. Water. It was water. Drink water.
Well, with that in mind, I'm Ryan.
And I am Jeremy.
And may this is scriptured badly. May all of your evenings be spent either by yourself or with people you love, depending on your preference. The end. Bye.